Chapter 18, The Yoga of Liberation by Renunciation. Arjuna says, I desire to know separately, O mighty armed one, the truth of sannyasa, O Hrishikesha, as also of Tyaga Krishna. The Holy Lord says, renouncing desire-based action, sages consider sannyasa. Abandonment of all works fruits, the wise declare to be Tyaga. Some say action should be renounced as an evil, while others say that sacrifice, austerity, and gift should not be relinquished. Hear the conclusions regarding Tyaga, O best of Bharatas. Tyaga has been declared to be of three kinds, O tiger of men. Sacrifice, gift, austerity should not be relinquished but done. Sacrifice, gift, austerity are purifying to the wise. But even these works, Arjuna, should still be performed, though leaving attachment and the fruits, such is my best and certain conviction. But the renunciation of required action is not proper. Abandonment from delusion is declared to be tamasic. The relinquishment of action from fear of trouble or of pain is rajasic relinquishment, producing not the fruit thereof. When work is done only because it should be done, leaving aside attachment and the fruit as well, that relinquishment is sattvic. Relinquishers of sattvic kind, steadfast with doubts dispelled, hate not uncongenial work, nor are they attached to the congenial work. Actions cannot be entirely relinquished by the embodied, but the relinquishing of fruits of action is relinquishment. The threefold fruit of all action, uncongenial, congenial mixed, accrues to non-relinquishers, but not to the relinquishers. Learn from me these five causes for the accomplishment of all works, as are declared in the Sankhya, which is the end of all action. The body agent, the senses, the functions of manifold kind, the presiding divinity, and that which is also the fifth. Whatever action a man performs by his body, speech, and the mind, whether right or just the reverse, these five alone are its causes. He who through a non-purified understanding looks on his self, the absolute, as the agent he of distorted mind sees not. He who's free from egoism, with intelligence untainted, although he kills all these people, he kills not, neither is he bound. Knowledge, the known, and the knower form the threefold cause of action. The instrument, purpose, agent are the threefold base of action. Knowledge, action, and agent are declared by Sankhya to be of three kinds from the distinction of gunas, hear them also duly. That by which in all is seen the one indestructible substance, inseparate in the separate, know that knowledge to be sattvic. But that by which in all are seen many beings of many kinds, as different from one another, know that knowledge as rajasic. Confined to a single effect as the whole and without reason or basis in truth trivial, know that knowledge as tamasic. Action without love or hatred and without desire for the fruit and freed from any attachment, know that action is called sattvic. Actions done desiring desires with self-conceit and much effort, O Dhananjaya, know as truth, that action is called rajasic. action that's done through delusion without heed to the consequence, loss, damage, or ability. Know that action is tamasic. An agent free from attachment, humble, endued with courage and ardor, and unaffected in success or failure is sattvic. One passionate, desirous of actions, fruits, greedy, malignant, impure, easily elated, or dejected is rajasic. Unsteady, vulgar, obstinate, wicked, dishonest, indolent, despondent, procrastinating, such an agent is tamasic. Now hear the triple distinction of intellect and fortitude according to the three gunas, exhaustively and severally. That intellect which knows the paths of work and renunciation, right and wrong acts, fear, fearlessness, bondage and freedom is sattvic. That intellect of mistaken apprehension of dharma and a dharma of right and wrong acts, that intellect is rajasic. That intellect enveloped in darkness, regarding a dharma as dharma and seeing all things distortedly, is tamasic. Fortitude by which the functions of the mind, prana, and senses are regulated unswerving by means of yoga is sattvic. That by which one regulates the mind to dharma, desire, and wealth from attachment to all their fruits, that fortitude is rajasic. That by which the stupid does not give up sleep, fear, despondency, grief and overweening conceit, that fortitude is tamasic. Now hear from me of the threefold happiness whose enjoyment is learned by practice and by which one attains unto the end of pain. That which is like poison at first, but like amrita at the end, born of self-realization's light, that happiness is called sattvic. That arising from the contact of object with sense at first like amrit, but like poison at last, that happiness is rajasic. That which begins and results in self-delusion arising from sleep, sloth, and miscomprehension, that is declared as tamasic. There is no entity on earth or in heaven among the gods found devoid of these three gunas, born of Prakriti Arjuna, of Brahmins and Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, as also of Shudras. The duties are distributed according to guna nature. Calmness, restraint, austerity, purity, patience, uprightness, knowledge, discernment, piety, these are the duties of Brahmins. Valor, splendor, courage, and skill, also not fleeing from battle, generosity, sovereignty, these are duties of Kshatriyas. Agriculture, husbandry, trade are the duties of the Vaishyas, and Shudra's duty is service arising from innate nature. Devoted to his own duty, man attains highest perfection. How by his duty he attains perfection, that now hear from me. From whom all beings do come forth, by whom all this is pervaded, worshipping him with his duty, a man attains to perfection. One's own dharma, though imperfect, is better than another's, though done to perfection. The duty of one's own nature brings no ill. The duty to which one is born should not be relinquished, although faulty, for as the fire by smoke, so defect envelops all deeds. He whose mind is ever detached, with subdued heart, without desires, attains by renunciation to perfect freedom from action. Arjuna, learn from me in brief how, having reached such perfection, he attains Brahman, that supreme consummation of all knowledge. Endued with a pure intellect, subduing body and senses, relinquishing the sense objects, leaving attraction and hatred. Dwelling in a secluded place, with body, speech, and mind controlled, abstemious, ever engaged in meditation, dispassionate. Forsaking ego, power, pride, lust, wrath, possessiveness, freed from the notion of mind, and tranquil, he's fit for union with Brahman. One with Brahman, tranquil-minded, neither grieving nor desiring, the same to all he thus attains, supreme devotion unto me. Devoted, he knows me in truth, what and who I am, then having known me in my reality, he forthwith enters into me. Though doing all actions always, always taking refuge in me, by my grace he attains to the eternal, immutable state, resigning mentally all deeds to me as to the highest goal, resorting to buddhi yoga, thus ever fix your mind on me. With mind fixed on me you shall, by my grace, surmount all obstacles, but if from self-conceit you will not hear me, then you shall perish. If filled with pride and self-conceit, you wrongly think I will not fight, in vain shall be this your resolve, for your nature will compel you. Fettered by your karma, born of your nature, what you deluded, desire not to do, you shall have to do, though in spite of yourself. O Arjuna, the Lord dwells in the hearts of all beings, causing them by his Maya to revolve, as if mounted on a machine. O Bharata, with all your heart, take refuge in him, and you shall surely attain unto supreme peace and the eternal abode. Thus has wisdom more secret than all other secrets been declared to you by me. Now reflect on it fully, then do as you please. Now hear again my supreme word, most secret of all, because you are dearly beloved of me. Therefore I shall speak for your good. Fill your mind with me, devoted, sacrifice and bow down to me. You shall reach me, for truly I promise you, you are dear to me. Relinquishing all dharmas, you shall take refuge in me alone. Then I shall fully liberate you from all sins, wherefore grieve not. Never speak this to one without austerities or devotion, or one who renders not service, or to one who cavils at me. He who with supreme devotion to me teaches this most supreme secret unto my devotees shall doubtless come to me alone. Nor among men is there any who does dearer service to me, nor shall there be another on this earth dearer to me than he. And he who studies this sacred dialogue of ours shall worship me by knowledge's sacrifice. This is my certain conviction. And even that man who hears this, full of faith and free from scoffing, he liberated shall attain the happy worlds of the righteous. Has this been heard, O Pritha's son, by you with a one-pointed mind? Moreover, has the delusion of your ignorance been destroyed? Arjuna said, yeah, destroyed is my delusion, and I have gained my memory through your grace, and my doubts are gone. I am firm, I will do your word. Sanjaya said, thus have I heard this wonderful dialogue of Vasudeva and the high-souled son of Pritha, causing my hair to stand on end. By grace of Vyasa have I heard the supreme most secret yoga, direct from Krishna, yoga's Lord, himself the one declaring it. I recall again and again this wondrous holy dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, and rejoice again and again. As I recall and recall that most wondrous form of Hari, great is my wonder, O King, and I rejoice again and again. Wherever is Krishna, Yoga's Lord, wherever is Arjuna, there are splendor, victory, wealth, and right order, such is my conviction. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, and the 18th discourse entitled The Yoga of Liberation by Renunciation.
Thank you, Kamuda Janice, for that glorious recitation of the Bhagavad Gita in English. As we begin, and this is our last official class, though we're going to have next week at the same time, next Wednesday, the 19th, we're going to have an extra bonus class, which you're welcome to join or not, but which I totally recommend you do join, in which we're going to have the opportunity to break into triads, and I'll give you some questions or statements from the Gita to discuss, and you can, of course, also talk about your experience. You know, it's something that I think many of us have wanted to do in the course of this time together, so we'll have at least one chance to do it. I'm also hoping to answer questions tonight, but if not, I will definitely ask them to answer questions next week. And Deb wants you to know that there is a link to register for this. We have to register for it separately because it's going to be on Maestro Conference, which is a different conference line that allows us to actually break into dyads and triads. You need to register, and you can do that for free, of course, at the link on the course page. So let's start with the chant and our initial meditation. Actually, before we do, I really, really want to thank you guys for these magnificent contemplations on the gunas that you've been sharing. I'm always so moved by the level of wisdom and practice that is exhibited by those of you in this sangham. I think it's revelatory for all of us and really an expression of the guru flowing through the class, flowing through each one of you. And it also feels that for so many of you, even as you've known about the gunas for years, you know, everyone who studies yoga learns about the gunas, you know, even kind of grocks the gunas. But it still feels as though there's been some revelation in these exercises, and it's definitely been true for me in contemplating the shaktis, because the three gunas are shaktis for sure. Over the last couple of weeks, the practice of tuning into my physical experience as well as to the mental consciousness to sense what it feels like for me personally to be in the state of each of the gunas has been incredibly powerful, and I think that's true of many of you as well. Thinking about the gunas helps us understand them, but when we really have the intention to master our inner states, to actually get to know them from inside and physically, emotionally, and mentally work with our energies, then we start to realize that the gunas, the three gunas, our own sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic mind states and body states actually are the material that we use to create a better reality. And we do this by knowing them first and recognizing what each guna feels like as it rises. We learn when to intervene by doing a state-shifting practice, like substituting a mantra or going for a walk or doing an act of service for someone or something. And then, so we get to know when to do a practice to help shift the gunas, and we also get to know when to simply be a witness of that shifting state. And I hope that you're experiencing that as you observe the play of your own states of activity and excitement and desire and anger and sleepiness and negativity and drive and ambition and lust and intoxication and beautiful, open, spacious states, that you discover how even just feeling into the felt sense of a particular guna can start to shift it. So we're going to chant the sattvic syllables of this invocatory mantra, and then we're going to do a meditation practice, and consider that in so doing, we begin always by sitting in our bodies or sitting as our bodies and feeling into the state of the body right now. You know, the body obviously is tamasic. It's kind of intrinsically tamasic because it's dense. But at the same time, it has rajasic and sattvic gunas running through it. And when we bring awareness, which is our ultimate sattvic resource, into the body and begin to feel how the body feels, to center our attention in the body and literally bring our sattvic intention into our physicality, something that, of course, we do every time we practice asana or hold ourselves in a comfortable upright posture, but which we especially experience when we learn the exquisite practice of being mindfully present inside our physical being. Let's just start by breathing into our toes, breathing into the big toe on both feet, both big toes. And as you exhale, just explore the feeling of the toe, whether it's inside your socks or barefoot, whether you feel it pressing against your thigh because you're sitting in a cross-legged posture or against the floor. Just feel the big toe as you inhale and exhale. And now the second toe. The third. Inhale and exhale through the fourth toe. Through the little toe, the baby toe. And then have the sense of inhaling through the soles of the feet and feeling the breath flowing up the legs and into the lower belly, into the hara, the lower dantian, three finger widths below the navel, in the very center of the body. And as you inhale and exhale, just for a moment, see if you can feel the breath flowing inside the belly. The inhalation bringing your awareness into this subtle space inside the belly. It's a subtle body space that we access through the by moving our awareness around the lower abdomen until we hit the space, almost like plugging a electrical cord into the socket. Now we'll chant three times the invocational mantras. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yad kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. We offer this action of speaking and listening and practicing with Krishna's teachings in the Bhagavad Gita. We offer these actions asking that they contribute to the well-being of all beings and to the earth. And with your eyes closed and your attention initially in the lower dantian in the hara, now begin to receive the breath that flows through the body from the crown, having the feeling that Krishna, in the form of the great light of consciousness, in union with his Shakti, the goddess Lakshmi, the two of them occupying one body, that in their blazing form of light and grace, they are offering rays down that flow down through the crown of your head with the inhalation, flowing through your body. And then with the exhalation, flowing out through the crown. And feel in this meditation that with the inhalation, the breath flows in with the thought, I am. The mantra, I am. Feeling that you're actually breathing in Krishna. Krishna's Shakti, the Shakti of Vishnu Lakshmi, is flowing into your body with the breath through the crown and flowing through your entire body, literally carrying sparkles of cosmic energy, cosmic light, and cosmic love into your cells. And then with the exhalation, you offer that gift back through the crown to Krishna. I am flowing in. And then with the out-breath, I am that. Meaning, I am Krishna. I am the Absolute. I am the highest love. So you breathe in, I am, as Krishna's light flowing through the body. You exhale, I am that, sending it back with the realization that the breath comes from the highest, enlivens the body, which is also a form of the highest, and then offers itself back, breath as giving and receiving. I am breathing in. I am that. Breathing out. And you can open your eyes if you feel like it, or keep them closed. We'll be returning to this meditation several times in the course of the evening. And in this class, we're going to talk a little bit more about the gunas, because Krishna does. And then we're going to speak about the culmination of the Gita. We're working with chapter 18 this week, and Chapter 18 is, of course, it's said in Yaneshwari that chapter 18 is the jewel on the crown of the Gita. It's the dome on the temple of the Gita. It's both the Krishna's bringing it all together for Arjuna, and it's also really, I would say, the moment when Arjuna actually experiences union with Krishna. And that's, of course, the whole point of the Gita, and we could certainly argue the whole point of our human life. Several years ago, actually quite a few years ago now, maybe 15 years ago now, I was going through a period of feeling very sad and confused and, you know, sort of one of those phases of sadhana where you feel like you're walking through mud. And one night in the midst of it, I was crying a lot, they weren't tears of joy, which I sometimes cry, and, you know, have been crying a lot since we've been studying the Gita. I've been crying a lot of joyful, devoted tears. These were not those kind of tears. And in the midst of it, I had a dream. And in the dream, I went with a young woman to sign up for graduate school at the University of Chicago. And we went to the office of the mentor who was going to assign us who was our thesis advisor and was going to assign us thesis topics, which I know is not usual. Normally you choose your own, but this is my dream. So he says to the young woman, "Your topic is sadness." And the young woman says immediately, "I don't want to write about sadness." So I said, "I can write about sadness. I know all about it." Thesis advisor looked me in the eye and said, "No, sadness is not your topic. Your topic is the undying grace of the Guru, which flows through the cosmos and takes the form of the human teacher. Your topic is the eternal grace of the Guru, which flows through the cosmos and takes the form of the human teacher." As we know, Bhagavad Gita is probably the greatest text on the guru-disciple relationship that exists. Arjuna is the quintessential worthy disciple, and Krishna exemplifies God as guru, which is one of the great secret teachings of the non-dual traditions in India, that God becomes the teacher. But more deeply to the point is that when the truth flows through the mouth of a human being, the real truth, the truth that makes hair stand up on end on your body or takes you into a new state of recognition of who you are, that truth comes from the highest. It's not, doesn't belong to the teacher. It's not a product of purely human speech, even though a human mouth and tongue may be delivering it. It is God's teaching, Shiva's teaching, Krishna's teaching. It's the teaching of the highest. It's the teaching of that one whom in the Western traditions describes himself as I am that I am. So that recognition of the importance of the guru actually comes from our understanding about the gunas. And I believe that's one of the reasons why Krishna actually devotes four chapters to talking about the gunas. It's four if you count chapter 16, which is about, you know, the difference between sattvic and between what Krishna calls the divine and the demoniacal. But it's really about the gunas. the divine realization being the sattvic one, and the other gunas being what Krishna in that chapter calls the demonic, although we have to take the use of the word demonic with a few grains of salt. And of course, one of the reasons why the gunas are such a major topic in the Gita is because of the gunas that we need to be rigorous about our practice. And it's because of the gunas that we need to constantly be asking ourselves, is this experience, is this knowledge, is what I'm hearing or seeing, is it the truth? You know, and if we waited until we were in a sattvic, motivated mood before getting on the cushion or getting on the mat or going to the altar or reading a sacred text or doing something nice for somebody else, we would never create a regular practice. In fact, we would hardly do anything except in the state of kind of frantic striving. And I know you know what I'm talking about. There's so many times when you sit for meditation feeling restless or sleepy, and you find out that just by staying in this position for a while, the longer you've practiced, the less time it takes. But for everyone, if you sit long enough, the gunas are going to shift. So, and as long as you keep bringing yourself back to the practice, you can trust that even the worst, most painful state will eventually morph. Especially when you're going through purification, which all of us do at some point, and some of us for a long time, it can feel painful to sit in meditation. And yet, we really need to do it, because it's only sitting in meditation. It's only letting yourself be fully present with whatever is arising, always with that part of the mind that we can call the will or the intellect, intending to center in the truth. It's only this that will let us begin to feel into an emerging sattvic state. Or you may, you know, find that it's skillful to incorporate movement into your practice. In other words, the teachings that will allow you to again and again and again create in your own consciousness a platform which makes it easy for the teachings of the guru, that is, the teachings of the great one, the one who delivers insight and awareness. It's really only by sitting consistently that we allow our consciousness to become the kind of sattvic container for the truth. And it's very significant that Krishna devotes these chapters to the gunas, and it's very significant that these are the final chapters. The gunas are really core to his teachings about how to live a yogic life. And I believe he's pointing out a couple of things which, as often with his teachings, are so paradoxical that they can almost seem contradictory. First, he obviously feels that in order to master your own life, you need to master your energies, which essentially means mastering the gunas. This is a very tantric idea, of course, that, you know, tantra is all about learning how to recognize, tune into your own energies, and then let them become the engines of your transformation. For Krishna, mastering the gunas, it isn't enough just to be the witness, although he completely, he teaches witness consciousness, he advocates witness consciousness. When he talks about the state of being beyond the gunas, he speaks of witness consciousness as the key to it. Nonetheless, it's not enough for him for us to be the witness. We actually need to cultivate sattva guna and to monitor the way the other gunas play in us. And of course, everyone in this sangam has been doing this for years, some many, many years. And as a result, even in their most painful and gnarly moments, we are relatively sattvic. Even if, you know, your tamaguna is, as Aaron said in one of his posts, your tamaguna is light tamas. It won't look like the tamas of, you know, to give an extreme example, of a heroin addict or a terrorist, or, you know, even a a person who doesn't follow his conscience, you know. So So your Rajaguna won't look like a competitive runner or a hedge fund trainer or a Navy SEAL or, you know, somebody who's just started a new company. You know, or for that matter, it's not going to look like the Rajaguna of a, you know, a 10-year-old playing baseball. So we all have subtle gunas, where our gunas have been subtilized, even though the Rajas and Tamas might be very predominant in our makeup. They're in a kind of a cured form, an attenuated form. And you've also noticed, I'm sure, how practicing shifts the balance of the gunas, and how calibrating your practice will actually keep them in some form of balance. And recognizing, you know, your resistance to practice as tamaguna, and you know, the anxiety that sometimes runs through your body as Rajas Guna, or the desire for more and better spiritual experience as a form of Rajas Guna. These are very helpful to us. And Aaron also, among others, gave a very beautiful description of how as a practitioner we surf the gunas, you know, tempering the inertia of tamas by tapping into the fire energy of Rajas through exercise and exerting the will, and then recognizing the painful qualities that come when we overdo Rajas, and knowing to turn to meditation or mindfulness to touch into the purity of sattva. So working with the gunas is a lot like taking medicine or making a meal. It's actually a better analogy. Just as you need some spices and salt and oil to make a dish tasty, you need some spice and salt in the form of Rajas, and some gelatinous inertial grounding in the form of tamas, just to make your life work. And when you get the balance right, your intention to live with a predominantly sattvic mind actually lets you work with this guna masala. Masala, for those of you who don't speak Hindi, means a spice mixture. Your sattvic mind lets you work with the gunas in a way that keeps you growing with both a pure heart and an active will and a capacity to enjoy the relaxation of inertia when it's appropriate. And at the same time, and this I believe is another of Krishna's most important points, maybe the most important point, is that once you start investigating the play of the gunas, you realize you actually have no control over them. When you look into your own darkness, and by this I mean the dark thoughts and negative feelings that come up sometimes, especially when you're tired or sick, when you feel the habitual fear and pushiness and the raw desire or frustration that are whatever your combination of Rajaguna emotions is, you see that even after years of practice and a strong witness presence, you still fall sometimes into dull or deluded or anxious states, you know, where you have to have something or you can't stand something. All of those emotions, you know, including some that we're all very ashamed of, you realize that you actually cannot control the rise and fall of the gunas, that there is probably not going to be a time when you're just living in sattva guna every minute of every day. And I hope that you don't mind my saying this, because it's not that I'm trying to limit you or to limit your capacity for purity of mind and heart. Just saying that we are creatures of prakriti, and the three gunas are her nature. Yet in letting Arjuna know, and again, this is, I would say, the key point here, by letting Arjuna know that the three gunas are always going to be playing across this body and mind, Krishna brings home his core message that Arjuna and you and me cannot cross the battlefield without grace, cannot cross samsara without grace. You know, there's a wonderful poem by the great Indian saint Mirabai, which says, "Oh, it's a song to Krishna, who is her beloved. Oh Lord, this ocean is vast and my boat is so small. If you don't take me across, how will I ever get across?" Because we're under the control of Shakti, the great goddess consciousness, appearing in her lower form, her form the form she takes once Maya has come into the equation. So because we're utterly under the control of Shakti appearing as Prakriti and acting with her three great powers of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas as purity, as activity, as dullness, we need her, meaning Krishna, because Krishna and goddess are not two. We need her, that, to keep lifting us out of the sinkholes of tamasic inertia and the alluring but ultimately spiky tornado of rajasic desires, including, of course, the desire for spiritual fulfillment. So ultimately, as awake humans, we can cultivate our capacity to swerve into sattva guna at will. We can learn to be the witness. We can keep coming back to it. Much of the time we can observe the gunas even as they're moving through us. But what Krishna is telling us, and which I know from my own experience, is that we don't get to this place except by the grace of the Guru. I just want to spend a minute or two talking about the Guru and Krishna as the Guru, partly because this is the week of Guru Purnima, and because one of the revelations that came down for me, and I suspect for some of you, those of you who knew it was Guru Purnima and decided that you would tune into it, one of the revelations that came down was the revelation of Krishna as the embodiment of what Kashmir Shaivism says the Guru really is, which is, you know, Kashmir Shaivism, the tantras in general, point out again and again and again that the Guru is not a human being. The Guru is the grace-bestowing power of the Supreme, the Anugraha Shakti that flows through the cosmos, as in my dream. So Krishna in the Gita, and Krishna has many forms. He's a very full emanation of divine energy. So Krishna in the Gita isn't the adorable teenager who danced with the cowherd maidens in the forest of Vrindavan. He's not also not the king of his clan, as he is in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna is Guru in the Gita. He's the one who shows you the truth. He's the one who rips the veils off and lets you know that you are God incarnate in this body. In the Kalarnava Tantra, which is one of the great non-dual tantric texts on Guru, among other things, it's said that there are several kinds of gurus. There are actually many kinds of gurus who perform different functions and very different levels on which we encounter the guru. Gurus, in other words, come in different states of consciousness, which means that there are many, as we pass along in the journey, we discover that there are actually many teachers, some of whom show up, you know, for a limited time, who take us to the next stage. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a famous character, a famous enlightened character, who's the divine guru Dattatreya, who says that he's had 24 gurus, including a bird, the ocean, the moon, in other words, the world becomes your guru. So on one level, the guru is, or let me say a guru, a competent teacher, can be simply someone who teaches you the skills you need to live a spiritual life. And this is very valuable and important. But on the highest level, the guru is that energy of awakening, the Shakti that can radiate like a lightning bolt and open your mind and open your heart to the truth of who you are. A skill which has nothing to do with the guru's charisma or the guru's verbal skills, but simply with, let's call it, the decision that consciousness herself has made to act through a particular human being at a particular moment to channel the awakening, grace-bestowing Shakti. Of course, this works best if the guru's teachings are coming from an enlightened state, but it also doesn't demand enlightenment on the part of the teacher, which is something that we don't always understand. However, when we talk about Krishna, who is a unique form of the Supreme Being, we're talking about the grace-bestowing power in what we could call an incarnate form. And of course, Buddha's teachings have this same quality of downloading enlightenment. In fact, in the Puranas, Buddha is considered to be an avatar of Vishnu, the same form of the divine that Krishna is. And Jesus, of course, is the form of the Guru that we're most familiar with in the West. And again, his teaching has the same quality that Krishna's have of being able to penetrate not only the intellect, but also the heart, and to kindle devotion in somebody. And I think that this is what's happening for so many of you as we study this together. This feeling of the arising of love and awareness is completely the result of our connection with the Guru principle as it comes through Krishna, who I believe, though I don't know for sure, but it is definitely my experience, is that Krishna, or that Shakti, that power that calls itself Krishna, that face of the divine reality that calls itself Krishna, has made a decision that wherever a group of people are studying the text with a pure-hearted desire to learn what he has to offer, that he will be present fully. It's, you know, one of those promises, like Jesus' promise that wherever two or more are gathered in my name, I'll be present. Krishna says, wherever Krishna and Arjuna are remembered, Krishna is there. So praising the Guru is deeply important for spiritual progress. Understanding the need for the Guru is tremendously important for spiritual progress. I often hesitate to give this teaching because, other than acknowledging my own lineage, because I know that not everyone has the destiny to meet a fully enlightened Guru in this lifetime. And so I often will hesitate to talk about the Guru because I really don't want anybody to get the idea that you need an enlightened master to be successful in practice. Definitely we need teachers. Definitely we need teachers whose lineage is reliable, who carry lineage Shakti. And it has to be a true lineage, an enlightened lineage. That is, I would say, crucial. It's it's really the bottom line of spiritual life. That said, the Guru is not someone or something outside us. Every one of us carries a Guru inside us, and I know that as you read each other's insights, you see how active Guru is in this group of people. And it may have something to do with the intention of my own Guru lineage, because my Guru, Swami Muktananda, was in love with the Gita, especially the Jnaneshwar version. And his love for the Gita, I believe, has transmitted itself to me. So, which is why I tend to burst into tears at certain moments as I'm reading the Gita. But what I'm feeling as I read the text in your company is that what's happening in this class is unique to every individual because it's uniquely coming down from your personal connection to the Guru principle. And that said, you know, to you, the face of the Guru may not look like Krishna's face. It may not even look like the face of, you know, a teacher from the Sanatana Dharma, from the Indian spiritual tradition. But it doesn't matter, because whatever the words of the teaching, once you've connected to the Guru, truth is going to come through every word of every verse of the great spiritual texts that express this truth. And I believe that Krishna's intention in this in the Gita is to activate the cosmic Guru principle for each of us so that we can experience that guidance and that grace forever just by remembering Guru or remembering Krishna. That intention threads through the text along with the ethical teachings and the picture of what it's like to follow the path of action, knowledge, and devotion that Krishna is showing. And that gift of awakening the heart's capacity to hear from within the truth is always a gift of grace, which my guru once defined as the power that returns us to our source, that opens the doorway to true self-knowledge. So, Jai Guru, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha, grace is our birthright. And in chapter 18, which is, you know, the chapter, as we said, where Krishna brings everything together, he's going to bring this point home. The name of this chapter is Yoga of Liberation by Renunciation. And you know it's important because the word liberation or moksha is the holy grail of Indian spirituality. So it starts with Arjuna's question. And remember, the Gita begins with the basic problem of human action, the problem of human life. I would say it's the core problem of human life. How do we do what is required of us to live in this world, which can be pretty difficult, which will always tend to entangle us in separation and duality and the emotions that go along with them? How do we do what we need to do while staying focused on the self? It's both the dilemma and the opportunity of life in the world. And traditionally, this dilemma has been dealt with for serious people, you know, by counseling us to abandon action. In other words, to become sannyasis. Sannyasa literally means leaving aside or putting aside or abandonment. And it means abandonment of action. The idea is that you actually stop doing everything, including your practices, including earning a living, including taking money, including cooking food. That, in other words, you live by accepting what comes to you without effort. That's traditional sannyas. Sannyas is basically a way of cutting through the problem. You just eliminate the problem of action by not doing any action. And of course, Krishna would say that you're always doing some action, or Prakriti is always acting through you, but you give up doing actions that require desires. And very often, sannyasis wear visible robes, orange robes, and have no possessions. Again, we're talking about the tradition. I know a lot of sannyasins who don't live without possessions, but a true sannyasin in the traditional sense has completely given up everything that feels comfortable. When I received initiation into sannyasa from my guru back in 1982, the swamis, went through our own funeral rites, and then we immersed ourselves several times in the local river while reciting vows, which included renouncing the pleasures of the earthly world, and the middle world, and the heavenly world. Then when we emerged from the river, we were supposed to set off for the Himalayas to practice austerities in a cave. But as part of the ceremony, the officiant, who is a senior swami, called us back to serve humanity. And then we said, I give refuge to all beings. And I ask God to give refuge to me. So that's basically sannyasa. And it was regarded as a death from which you did not come back to normal life. One of the critical biographical details about Nyaneshwar Maharaj, who came from a family of deep practitioners, young practitioners, he and his brothers and sister were the children of a sannyasin. Their father had left home, renounced his worldly life, renounced his wife to become a swami and wander. But they had no children at the time, and his wife went to the guru who had given her husband initiation into sannyas and said, you know, it's not correct for a man to leave his wife, to renounce his wife, without giving her a child. So the guru demanded that Yaneshwar's father come back to his wife and have children. So they had four kids, and after which the father again took off for the territories. But in the meantime, because it was such an unheard of thing to do, to renounce your renunciation, the whole family became social outcasts. So Yaneshwar and his two brothers and his sister had no place in the world, which undoubtedly contributed to their, you know, their profound state of dispassion, which was in them since childhood. So Krishna doesn't reject this type of sannyasa. In fact, he acknowledges it as a highly respected way of hardcore practice. But he believes it's problematic and that it certainly doesn't solve the problem of human action to just stop doing anything at all. It's actually no help to the rest of us that serious yogis give up their families and give up their work. Instead, he recommends what he calls tyaga, T-Y-A-G-A, which he defines as abandoning not your activities, but your desire for the fruit of your good actions, because he also insists that we need to go on performing the dharmic actions that are required of us. Tyaga, the state of renunciation that he recommends, means you never stop your work, your seva, your charity, taking care of your family and those who need your help. It's just that where a non-yogi does these things expecting a reward in one way or another, the true yogi just does it because it's a good thing to do and does it without attachment, does it dispassionately. And Krishna says that the kind of renunciation where you give up your worldly activities because it's too hard to keep your job and deal with your family and still do spiritual practice, that is tamasic renunciation. Good to know. Being one of those people who kind of learned this lesson the hard way, as I said in the first class, it wasn't at all unusual for people in my generation who'd had a big awakening to leave their family to go off to Nepal or India or Thailand or just wander around Asia looking for a teacher. And people used to come to my guru quite regularly and, you know, try to give him all their money or the deeds to their houses out of a devoted misunderstanding of what it means to give up desires. He almost always, with very, very few exceptions, he almost always gave it back to them, saying things like, how will you take care of yourself if you give them all that, if you give me all this? My favorite story in this way is the story about a guy who came up to my guru and said, I renounced working 5 years ago, and ever since then, God has been taking care of me. And my guru said, have some mercy on God and get a job. So that he had the attitude that Krishna had. The question of how we carry out our worldly activities and also make spiritual progress is what this entire text is meant to explain to us. And in verses 12, 13, and 14 of chapter 18, he reiterates one of the really big teachings about karma yoga. And again, I just want to point out, you know, even though we've been working with it a lot, it's really quite a radical teaching. And it's kind of easy to misunderstand. He says in verse 12 that when you've renounced all egoic desire for results of your actions, that anything that you do is free from the karmic boomerang. In other words, the effects of the action, even if the effects are dire, do not touch you. What this means, this classical teaching of Hindu and Buddhist spirituality, it's in its own way, it's, even though it's not specific, it's kind of a basic teaching of mystical Christianity as well. But what I believe is that what Krishna really means is that it's the soul, the jiva, that's free from the results of actions. In other words, the body is going to have to suffer the results of whatever it does, meaning if you smoke, you'll damage your lungs, no matter how detached you are. If you jog, you might improve your respiratory system, but you risk blowing out your knees. And in the same way, even if your actions are free from ego, they can still have a negative impact and even bring unintended harm to you as an individual, embodied individual. Or you might be completely sattvic, but still suffer from the projections of others. as in some of the beautiful Zen stories about practitioners who were accused of various criminal activities by ignorant villagers or even their own students who, because of their enlightened state, were able to say, okay, if that's what you think, and let it go. And this is, of course, why Krishna speaks so much about dispassion and fortitude and equanimity, simply because he knows that stuff happens to everybody. In verse 13, he gives a kind of an interesting technical piece about actions and the fruits of actions. He says that everything we do comes about as a result of five factors coming together: the physical body, the instruments you use, such as, you know, the computer, the type of effort you make, whether it's skillful or not, and the doer, the sense of who is doing it, and finally, the cosmic forces acting on the situation, that is to say, the effects of karma and history and planets. At the heart of this is the recognition that the doer in any action, the causative doer in any action that you commit or any action that is committed anywhere, is not any individual, but Prakriti. So your personal ego, which claims activity, has actually nothing to do with it. Physically and psychically, the body, mind that will perform actions belong to Prakriti. So the true doer on the highest level is the self, the dynamic power of Shakti and the detached intelligence that Krishna calls Purushottama, the Supreme Being. And the body can be doing something terrible, like fighting a battle, as Arjuna is about to do. And yet, there can be a sense that we are not the doers of it. So that state that we sometimes call flow, where everything seems to be happening on its own, is something that ordinary people, especially people with a strong athletic skill or musical skill, people who have mastered their instrument or their work or their art, can have this experience of the action just flowing through them with no sense that they're doing it. And then, you know, this is that moment when an actor feels the character take over, or the athlete feels that someone else is serving or pitching. Similarly, when Arjuna fights this battle, once he's finished with hearing and receiving Krishna's teaching, he is going to be able to allow his body to engage in the battle without in any way identifying with it. So Krishna then goes on to give a little more teaching about how the gunas operate. And what's interesting about the way he talks about the gunas in this chapter is that he's actually speaking of the main qualities at the heart of the divine, the powers of God: knowledge, blissfulness, the feeling of blissfulness or happiness, and action, as they look when the different gunas are at play. And one of the things he says is that the type of action we perform and the way we understand it has everything to do with how we experience, how we see reality. In other words, the nature of our knowledge, or as we might say, attitude is everything. Tamasic action is mechanical. It's it's when our habitual patterns guide all of our actions. So you eat and drink without noticing what you're eating. You speak harshly or carelessly or a lie, tell lies out of a complete unconsciousness of what the right thing to say or do or eat is. It's, you know, it's like tamasic activity is like that statement, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, hoping you'll get a different result. And of course, tamasic action also has its dark side, which we won't discuss right now, but which I think we're all very aware of. Rajasic knowledge can be very sophisticated, it can be very aesthetic, can be very skillful, can be very intellectually acute, but it's always based on the sense of separation. So even if you understand interconnectedness intellectually, or if you understand ethics, or even if you really intend to do good things in the world, as long as there's the, you know, the belief that you are the doer, and as long as you have a desire for a particular result in the action, you're going to be upset when things don't come out well, or when you're blamed or caught out or not seen as a good person. And I often think of some of the people I know who devoted their lives to environmental activism, and they're really, really good people. You know, they have very high motivations, and they've done a lot of personal sacrifice. They managed to get a lot of environmental protective laws on the books. They even managed to stop a few oil pipelines temporarily. So now there's a new administration, and a lot of those laws are simply being overturned, although it's not that easy to overturn a law, but it is possible to not enforce it. So as I talk to some of these guys and listen to them talking about how their life's work has come to nothing and feel their pain and realize this is what Rajasic action does for you. It's, you know, even the best, most productive, most helpful, most noble activity that we can do is going to cause suffering if we do it with any kind of desire. And similarly with happiness, Rajasic happiness comes when you get what you want, but it doesn't last, as we've just seen, because, to quote Donald Trump, we can't always win. Krishna says that Rajasic happiness is pleasant in the beginning, but poison in the end. And one of my friends who listens to the news on MSNBC, she's kind of a political junkie, and every time she gets in the car, she turns on the radio and she gets lost in the news cycle, which is, of course, a roller coaster ride these days. So a constant addictive fix for political junkies. And she's started to notice how she feels after a session of listening to MSNBC. The sattvic person's knowledge and activity and happiness comes from the recognition of underlying oneness. So Krishna's description of what a sattvic mind is like is very close to the description of what an enlightened person looks like and acts like. That's they're very, very close in his description. I would say the difference between sattva guna and the state of full, complete enlightenment is that sattva guna it's impermanent. You know, you might be very, very enlightened at this moment and at the next moment be completely bummed out or attached or angry. Someone whose nature is predominantly sattvic, however, knows the skills of bringing herself or himself out of a state of ignorance or tamasic or rajasic emotion and coming back again and again and again to the ground of sattva, the ground of awareness. And here Krishna says that sattvic activity, I'm translating this into modern terms, sattvic activity is not stressful like rajasic activity, which always involves some kind of strain or extra effort, and it's not lazy like tamasic effort or based on ignorance like tamasic effort. It's actually inspired by an intuition of the right thing to do and by a motive of aligning with the divine will. So what happens is that over time, a sattvic doer can start to become more and more of an open channel for what Krishna calls my divine will and what Aurobindo calls soul force, that is the evolutionary imperative. Aurobindo and Krishna himself seem to indicate that there is this force that moves through the world that is taking consciousness to higher and higher states of recognition of the fact that everything that occurs is occurring inside this one field of grace. So a sattvic person learns to look for the universal power of will in everything and not to make a difference. This is something that's been very helpful to me to get. Not to make a distinction between my personal will and the will of the divine. In other words, to begin to understand that there is only one will in the cosmos, and that by aligning yourself with it, by intending to act in alignment with it, you actually become a channel for the enormous power of the divine will, and good things start to happen through your body, mind, and speech that, while often very profound and effective in the world, don't entangle you in the satisfaction that only comes from the fulfillment of desire. So here's the first major takeaway from the Gita, and of course we've been talking about it for weeks, and especially in the first course. The goal of our action is to think and act with awareness based on a sattvic perspective, meaning from an awareness of non-duality. And as we do, we experience sattvic happiness, which comes from intense effort performed for the sake of love, done because we know it's the right action and that we're the right person to perform it. Krishna describes this kind of happiness as being poisonous in the beginning because it means it's poison. He calls it poisonous because to perform sattvic actions, we actually have to go against sometimes the ego's wants and needs. It's poisonous at the beginning, but nectarian at the end. So we're going to do a practice from the Vijnana Bhairava, actually, a practice that I call non-dual, the key, the secret of non-dual ethics. So this is a sattvic touchstone. And we're going to, the core of it is that we're going to call to mind a feeling of a person or situation to whom we feel aversion, dislike, discomfort, and then we'll do it with a situation to which we are attracted. Close your eyes. You don't actually have to sit in a meditative posture. This is really a kind of a thought experiment, but meditative posture is always good. Think of a situation where you feel aversion or fear or stress. And feel the fallout in your inner psyche of dwelling in that situation. There's not something in your personal life that you can call to mind. You might want to think of something that's going on in the world. So really feel into your aversion, your discomfort, your dislike. Now have the thought, all this is part of my own awareness. Just notice the feeling as it arises. What happens as you hold this in the understanding, all this is part of my own awareness? This thing that I dislike is rising in my awareness. Of course, you're thinking about it, so you're not looking at it or, you know, standing in the midst of it, most of you anyway. So it's a thought experiment. It's, you know, it's not an on-the-hoof actuality. But notice what happens to a gnarly thought or emotion when you recognize this is all arising in my awareness. Now consider something you really, really want, whether it's for yourself or another person. And it could be something like wishing your child would be happy. Or it could be something that you, it could be, you know, could be to have the house you're looking at become available. It could be to have your relationship work out. It could, or your mother to be healthy, or yourself to be healthy, or for help to come to the people in Mosul, or for a solution to the refugee crisis in Syria. Pick one and feel into it an unfulfilled desire. And notice the effects of an unfulfilled desire in your psyche. Now have the thought, whatever happens, whatever the outcome of this desire, whether I attain it or do not attain it, it's all the play of the divine will. And let's take it one step further. Having, for me to have this desire, for you to have this desire, for you to want this, whatever it is a play of the divine will. That's the radical idea, the radical tantric idea. And whether or not this desire is fulfilled is the play of the divine will. And notice what happens to your consciousness. If various resistances and doubts are coming up, which sometimes happens when we feel frustrated about something that we believe would be really, really good, doesn't happen or feels like it won't happen, and we say, this is God's will, you know, we can say to ourselves, well, that's jive. But put doubts aside and just hold the feeling. And notice that if you really let yourself hold this idea, it's going to change the way you feel, at least a little bit, at least incrementally. So let's once again return to our initial meditation, allowing the breath to flow in through the crown with the feeling that each breath is being offered into your body by the soul of the universe, Krishna himself, Krishna in union with Lakshmi. Inhaling with I am, feeling that I am is being spoken by Krishna as he breathes love and light into your body. And then with the out-breath, have the thought, I am that, while you sense the breath flowing out through the crown and merging into the awareness of the great love above your head. Krishna coming into you as I am, your human self flowing back towards Krishna above the head with the thought, I am that. So here's Krishna wrapping up his core teachings on the three most important truths that he's been offering Arjuna throughout the text. And we could We could describe these core teachings as knowledge, that is, the remembrance and practice of oneness, of the interconnectedness and non-duality of this universe, and also of the fact that it is the expression of the divine. Secondly, action performed as an offering. And three, devotion as both the path and the goal. And it's these three powers coming brought together that constitute true karma yoga. And he, in these next verses, he begins once again to go into the topic of karma yoga, to review it really, and also of the teaching of swadharma, which he talked about in great detail in chapter 2. And swadharma meaning your own innate, the law of life that is your natural, that is your nature. Swadharma is your own natural rule of life, how you should be because of how you are. And swabhava, which is one of those Sanskrit words that we don't have an equivalent for in English. We don't have an equivalent for swadharma either, for that matter. But your swabhava is your fundamental natural attitude. So we said last week that a human being has the bhava of being a human being, and it's that bhava that makes him a human being. So your swabhava is the attitude that is most natural to you. And in verses 40 through 45, Krishna discusses swabhava and swadharma in terms of the four types of human beings. Those whose main interest is in knowledge, spiritual and scholarly knowledge and wisdom, whom he calls the Brahman or priestly type, the warrior type, like Arjuna, who are motivated by the desire towards adventure, rulership, leadership, fighting, competition, the artisan merchant type who makes and sells goods and keeps the wheels of society moving through all the different professions that human beings commonly practice, and the servant whose fulfillment is in being of service to others. It's very important not to equate these four human types with the social system of hereditary caste law, which is a social structure, kind of a, let's just not mince words, it's kind of an evil social structure. It's not about, you know, being born into a particular profession or strata of society. What Krishna is actually saying is that each of us are born with natural predilections, which are the result of the cultivation that we've done over lifetimes. So, for instance, part of my swadharma is being a writer. And I was born into a family of writers, couple of generations of writers in my family. And so, you know, I managed to, you know, to be born in this lifetime into a situation in which writing and communication would kind of be breathed into me with my, you know, with my mother's milk, so to speak. It was part of the family bhava. But what Krishna would say is that that piece of, you know, of karma is the result of lifetimes of having cultivated those particular skills and approaches to life. You know, an attraction to knowledge and, to be completely honest, a basic lack of competence in certain other areas. So it's very obvious to me, and it's been very obvious to me, you know, for many, many years, what my swadharma is in the worldly sense. In other words, my swadharma has to do with communications. And on a deeper level, my swadharma, of course, is the swadharma of all of us, you know, which is the swadharma of knowing the self, which is the universal human swadharma that Krishna points out again and again operates no matter what work we're doing or, you know, even how tamasic we may be. Our swadharma always ultimately is to know God as the self. And his teaching on swadharma is really actually quite subtle. And in my experience and in, you know, in our current understanding of these teachings, it really has the swadharma of our worldly life really has to do with how the currents of the life force move us such that we can live our lives without stress and unhappiness caused by being a square peg in a round hole. So in other words, if it's not your dharma, if something is not your dharma, but you're doing it anyway, either because you want to or because it seems like what you're supposed to do, it's going to be majorly stressful. And we all know these stories about, you know, the kid who wanted to be an artist, but his father made him go into business, or the gay guy who, especially in the days before the 1970s, the gay guy who gets married because he can't admit that his actual sexual nature is, he's not sexually attracted to women. And in both situations, there's going to be suffering when you're not doing what is your natural, what is your nature, or if you, for instance, become a parent when you're actually not built to be a parent, it's not good for you, it's not good for the kids. And of course, we have spent many, many lifetimes, and many of us have spent years in this lifetime doing things, living with activities and ways of living that are not our swadharma, and suffered from that. So the word swabhava, as we've said, means your natural self. Your swabhava, however, although partly expressed in the ways, in the unique ways that you work and deal with the world, ultimately your swabhava is to recognize that your Godhead, your God, your self, your Krishna. So when Krishna talks about swabhava, what he essentially means is that it's important to have the recognition that no matter what else is going on in your life, you're God. So, and the secret that he's telling Arjuna is that our life in the world, our life in Prakriti, is actually a field that's meant to show us this. So, in other words, the suffering that we experience when we're not performing our natural action, when we're not living our swadharma, is part of the teaching that's meant to help us correct course. Your inner self is always Krishna. So the question is, how is this possible when we're so tied up by ego, by maya, by our outer directed senses, essentially being spun around like pots on a wheel? And here's the great good news of the Gita. We just keep performing our appropriate actions, the activities that we have the skills and temperament for, as a form of worship, then we will naturally evolve into the absolute perfection of our real nature. Here's what Aurobindo says. I love how he says it. He says, this machinery of ego, this tangled complexity of the three gunas, the mind, the body, vitality, emotion, desire, struggle, thought, aspiration, endeavor, this locked interaction of pain and pleasure, sin and virtue, striving and success and failure, soul and environment, myself and others, is only the outward form taken by a higher spiritual force in me that pursues through its vicissitudes the progressive self-expression of the divine reality and greatness that I am secretly in spirit and shall eventually become overtly. This whole thing is simply the slightly crooked or slightly imperfect expression that will eventually reveal itself to be God living as your unique self. So the whole catastrophe, the full tamasha of our life, contains at its core the stage of our ultimate triumph, growing into perfection. It is a done deal. That's what Krishna says. It's a done deal. We're already that. And we're being shaped from within into the perfection of our highest nature. My guru once said, I'm paraphrasing, those who follow this exalted path reach the truth just as the sun shines when the clouds dissolve. So a part of what this means, of course, is that this is a very long game, and we are, all of us here, we wouldn't be here if this wasn't true. All of us here are in the last innings of the game. This is the last half of the fourth quarter. maybe the last couple of minutes of the fourth quarter. And, you know, if we, when we can, when we look at geology, we realize this has been a really long game. I just read an article in The Atlantic about the Permian catastrophe, which is a planet-wide apocalypse that happened 252 million years ago, where all life was wiped off the planet, basically by global warming. It was not man-made, human-made global warming. It happened as a result of volcanic eruptions releasing the carbon dioxide in the seams of fossil fuels in the Earth. So 252 million years ago, all life was wiped out on this planet. And then 10 million years later, life came back. And according to Krishna and the laws of reincarnation, we have been evolving through all these different life forms pretty much ever since, maybe even before that. So we truly believe that from the non-dual perspective that one single consciousness is living as all this, including the land masses, we realize that this has been in the making for a really, really long time. And that just as the cells in our body work together to create, you know, the functioning of this organism, we as souls on this planet are part of a symphony that one of my teacher friends calls the unique self symphony, in which we're all, you know, being orchestrated together. And our consciousness never stops being Krishna. So for an evolutionary thinker like Aurobindo, the whole journey has the specific intention of producing beings like ourselves with the capability of becoming a conscious vehicle of the divine expression. Krishna doesn't say that exactly. What he does say is that you, as you are, meaning with your particular set of virtues and vulnerabilities and struggles, are the perfect vessel for fulfilling your part in the essential symphony of life. So even that question, what shall I do now, is one of the ways that consciousness helps us recognize our dharma in this particular moment. All of it's part of the tapestry. So given that Prakriti is always operating through us, and that grace is also operating through us, we can live our lives being subject to the play of the gunas, or we can do what Krishna wants Arjuna to do, which is fully take refuge in that and learn what it is to actually experience tyaga, or the action of non-action, or in Sanskrit, nishkama karma. Nishkama karma means literally actions performed without desire. And in verse 46 of chapter 18, Krishna gives what I believe is really the core teaching of the Gita. He from whom all beings originate, by whom all this universe is pervaded, by worshipping that through his own actions, a person reaches perfection. One from whom all beings originate, by whom all this universe is pervaded, worshipping that through your own actions, a person reaches perfection. So these two verses begin what I would call the final sweep of the Gita, the final act of the Gita. Krishna is going to explain to Arjuna another round of what is necessary for going to experience the absolute reality, but the way he does it is really important, because in the traditions, the Indian traditions, the Buddhist traditions, I would say even, you know, that Jesus's deep teaching, the fundamental idea is that what we're supposed to do is take rest in the absolute silence and stillness that the texts of Vedanta call Brahman, the absolute, the vastness, the great impersonal vastness, the silence, the pure I am. Krishna says we need to do this. We need to anchor our intellect in this pure awareness, in this pure I am. We need to learn to control the senses through the will, to be able to sit alone in order to meditate, to give up egotism, violence, anger, desire, the feeling of owning everything, anything. We need to do this practice because that's what gives us the platform to move into this silent stillness of Brahman over and over and over again until it becomes kind of our core state. This is very hard, but Krishna says it's only the beginning. And this, as we've discussed, is the unique genius of the Gita. It's why it's ultimately a tantric text. Krishna says that we absolutely need to know the impersonal absolute in order to experience the liberation that Krishna wants to give us. But that state is really only the preparation. In other words, the ultimate liberation and the purpose of it all is to recognize the presence of the divine in everything in the world. In other words, to see through the veil of Maya, stop thinking that everything we experience, including ourselves, is limited and separate, and start seeing Krishna manifesting as all this. So that's what we really want to take from this study. Someone asked my guru, do you see God in that tree? You know, my guru was always saying, see God in everything. He said, no, I see God as that tree, and I see God as you. So this is really the experience that Krishna is offering to Arjuna. And he's saying that we don't want only the liberation of silence, stillness, and detachment. We want to use silence, stillness, and detachment as the launching pad for experiencing what's called madbhava, which means the bhava of being madhava. That is, living as an expression of the divine force, the attitude of being God acting in the world. And Krishna says it arises out of devotion. It's not something that you get through the intellect or by doing self-inquiry, though Krishna is in no way dissing self-inquiry or the intellect. It comes only out of devotion, out of bhakti, but not ordinary devotion. In other words, not what people often mean when they talk about devotion, which is, you know, worshiping a form outside yourself, making offerings to a statue or making offerings at a synagogue, I'm sorry, not a synagogue, a church, or, you know, doing the religious practices that you do in a synagogue. It's not that kind of devotion. One of the Kashmiri poets sings, may I become a pilgrim of this world, experiencing only you in all things. So karma yoga is actually the enlightened activity of someone in this state. Karma yoga is the enlightened activity of someone who is alive in the delight of divine presence. And the reason why Krishna elevates the path of karma yoga to such a high place is not only because Arjuna is a man of action and Krishna is trying to get him to fight the battle, but because our practice of performing actions as offerings to the divine is literally a rehearsal for how our life will be when we actually attain the experience of oneness with the divine. It's kind of the ultimate as-if practice, not fake it till you make it, but aligning yourself with the divine by feeling that all your actions are for that. So there are three phases of doing this. First, the practice we've been doing of offering our actions, core practice. It's what we do when we still are identified with the ego. When we believe ourselves to be the actor or the doer, the separate self, we consciously turn our actions into sacrificial offerings, even turn our breaths into sacrificial offerings. Krishna describes this, of course, in Chapter 3, and we did a lot of practice with this in the first course. The second phase is the place we learn to act from when we recognize that we're not the doer, that Prakriti, the life energy of nature, is acting through our body and mind. So this is the beginning of non-doership. We start to be able to watch our body doing certain things. And if, you know, normally in the development of our spiritual life, this phase is something that develops out of our practice of making offerings. We start to see that our hands are actually moving kind of on their own, you know, that we start to, especially now that we have you know, so much information from neuroscience about what actually happens in the brain when the body moves, we start to see that our own will does not cause our actions. The third phase is the understanding that the force that moves us, the force that lives our life, is not just Prakriti, not just nature, but Shakti herself, the supreme power of the divine. In other words, that everything that occurs on this plane is actually the dance of the divine. And at this point, we surrender any sense of being a separate individual, and we begin to experience ourselves as instruments of the divine. Aurobindo says, all that we do is done for the sake of the Lord, seated in the heart of all, and for the fulfillment of his will for us, for the sake of the divine as the world, for the good of all beings. And it's actually being done as God, for God, by God. So this is the yoga of the Gita in a nutshell. If you still have an ego, do your actions as offerings. When you start to realize the energy that acts through you, recognize that it's not you doing it. And when you start to feel the divine nature of the power that acts as you, there's a natural growth in the experience of what Krishna considers real non-doership and real surrender, a natural allowing of the great divine will to act through your life. Krishna says, by devotion to me, he comes to know who I am in truth. Then having known me in truth, having truly known me, he immediately becomes one with me. Janeshwar calls this the fourth form of devotion. Remember that earlier in the book, Krishna says that there are four types of devotees. The ones who are suffering, looking for relief, the ones who are looking for wealth and success, the seekers of knowledge, and what he calls the wise, meaning those who know that Krishna is everywhere. And Yaneshwar says this form of devotion is actually the felt experience of oneness, and its nature is light. Krishna says, these are Yaneshwar's words, the wise call it knowledge of the self. The followers of Shiva call it Shakti. For a Shaiva Tantrika, that's a very crucial statement. The followers of Shiva call it Shakti, but I call it the highest devotion, Krishna says. Or, in the words of Nisargadatta, wisdom tells me I am nothing, love tells me I'm everything. These are the two phases of realization. The recognition that you don't exist as an ego, the recognition that you are everything as God. So, I want to move towards the culmination of this text by reading what Yaneshwar says about this state of realization, because he really, let's just put it like this, he totally nails it. So I'm going to pick and choose some of the pearls of Yaneshwar Maharaj's expansion of Krishna's words in the Bhagavad Gita. Basically, he says that the only knowledge that really matters is the knowledge that arises when you allow yourself to become one with Krishna, with the divine. Can anything that isn't space understand the nature of space? In the same way, a person who has not become one with me cannot know who I really am. Therefore, it cannot be said that he worships me. He who becomes one with me delights in me just as a young woman enjoys her youth. Similarly, such a person worships me without physically making offerings. But this cannot be described in words. It can only be known through experience. And he says that when such a person prays to me, I respond. Yet in this prayer, the speaker meets himself, and there is no speech. As soon as he speaks, he meets me, for I am the speaker. Whatever he sees with his eyes or perceives with his mind, the very act of seeing does away with it. Just as a person in front of a mirror sees his own face, in the same way the perception of such a being, such a person, will see himself as the seer in everything he sees. So this is Yanishwar's description of a state of non-duality. You become one with the Supreme, and therefore there's never any separation. In verse 56, the Gita says, performing all actions, one whose reliance is always on me attains by my grace the eternal imperishable abode. The Lord continued, O Arjuna, the yogi who faithfully follows the path of action, comes one with me, worshipping me with the pure flowers of his good action. He reaches the highest form of devotion through my grace. When he practices this form of devotion, worshipping me brings him delight, and he joyfully becomes one with me, realizing that I pervade the whole world. Just as salt may set aside its natural limits and dissolve in water, or as the wind may blow here and there and come to rest in the sky, in the same way, such a yogi finds refuge in me with his mind, speech, and body. If by chance he should commit some prohibited action, good and bad actions don't affect him once he's realized me. Just as great rivers and drain water from the streets are all one when they reach the sea. Both pure and impure gold have the same quality as soon as they are touched by fire. Similarly, actions appear to be good and bad only as long as a person doesn't experience me, the one, as illuminating all things. Therefore, O Arjuna, surrender all your actions to me. This renunciation consists of performing your appointed duties and at the same time concentrating your mind on discriminating between the real and the unreal. Then through that discrimination, you will see yourself as separate from activity and existing in my pure being. And he goes on to say, this is perhaps the most famous verse in this chapter, fixing your mind on me, you shall pass over all difficulties through my grace. But if through egotism you won't listen, then you will perish. When your mind becomes filled with me through wholehearted devotion, you may know that my grace is perfect. Misery and sorrow, which are the result of repeated births and deaths, however difficult, will be easy to bear. When the eyes are helped by the light of the sun, darkness has no power. Similarly, can the terror of earthly existence frighten a person whose ego has been obliterated through my grace? Fly unto him for refuge with your whole being, Arjuna. From his grace you shall attain supreme peace and the eternal abode. So take refuge in him with your consciousness, your speech, your mind, and your body, just as the waters of the Ganges flow into the great ocean. Then by his grace, you will be wedded to the bride of supreme peace and will enjoy the bliss of union with him. So this is kind of the final statement. Fix your mind on me, worshiping me, bowing down to me. In this way, you shall come truly to me. I promise. Krishna says, I promise, for you are dear to me. And here's the teaching, the core teaching, which Krishna has repeated again and again throughout the Gita, but in this chapter, he kind of brings it to its culmination. This is how you do it. O Arjuna, offer all your actions, inner and outer, to me, the all-pervasive one. Just as the wind fills the whole sky, be one with me in all your actions. Let your mind be entirely devoted to me, and let your ears hear only me. I am the supreme resting place. Let your voice be occupied in reciting my pure names so that they may enter your heart. Let your hands work for me. Your feet move for me. And in this way, let all your actions be done for my sake. O Arjuna, whether your actions benefit you or others, be my sacrificer performing these sacrifices for me. Considering yourself a servant, think of all others as being me, the one to be served. Giving up hatred towards any creature, be humble before all, as though you were bowing down to me. In this way, you will receive my full support. Then any idea of separation will disappear from your mind, and you and I will merge into one. And finally, Krishna says, abandoning all dharmas, take refuge in me alone. I shall liberate you from all evils, so do not grieve. And Yaneshwar expands on this. As desire gives rise to sorrow, as blame creates sin, and as misfortune brings about poverty. Similarly, ignorance, which that is to say the lack of understanding of oneness, which leads to heaven or hell, is the cause of good and bad actions. Therefore, rid yourself entirely of these. Just as the delusion that a rope is a snake is destroyed if a person grabs hold of it, and as activities in a dream come to an end when you wake up, as a mirage also vanishes when daylight ends, as fire dies out when the fuel is exhausted, cast out that ignorance, which is the cause of the illusion of good and evil, and give up all your religious practices. This is such a radical statement. When ignorance is dispelled, I alone remain, just as when sleep and dreams have passed, only myself is left. The knowledge of oneness with me, with no sense of separation, is the true meaning of taking refuge in me. A gold bead is made of gold, and a wave consists of water. In the same way, Arjuna, merge yourself in me. Get rid of any thought of resorting to me and retaining your separate individuality. Don't listen to false ideas, such as when a person attains union with me, the bond of his individuality isn't loosened. True devotion is to become one with me and serve me. Seek that knowledge by which this can be attained. True devotion is to become one with me and serve me. Seek that knowledge by which this can be attained. Krishna, in Yaneshwar's final words, says, when a person has attained union with me, nothing can remain except me. Therefore, don't concern yourself with good and evil. I myself am your sin and your merit. O Arjuna, just as when salt falls into water, it becomes water. In the same way, I will be your sole refuge. Let me enlighten you, and I will liberate you. So this is the kind of final moment of Krishna's teaching. After saying this, he reaches out and embraces Arjuna. And these are the words that Yaneshwar says, which I'm going to try to read to you, if my voice will allow it. And if not, there are verses 1408 to 1415 in Yaneshwari. Don't let your mind be anxious. Knowing me, take refuge in me alone. Lord Krishna, beautiful in form, the eye that sees in all vision, said these things. Then, stretching out his right arm, dark-skinned and adorned with bracelets, he embraced his beloved devotee. That high state of union from which speech turns back, taking the intellect with it, and which neither word nor thought can attain. This was the experience into which Krishna drew Arjuna under the pretext of his embrace. Just as one lamp lights another, in the same way he drew Arjuna into himself without removing the difference between them. Then Arjuna was overwhelmed by such a flood of joy that the Lord was submerged in it. If one ocean were to flow into another, the mass of water would be doubled, and the flood will fill the sky. So when the two embraced, the joy of their union past all bounds, and the whole universe was filled with the Lord. So please forgive my loss of voice. We're going to just take a few moments and contemplate this. With your eyes closed, allowing the breath to flow into the crown, feeling that Krishna is breathing into you with the thought, I am. Have the feeling as you exhale that you're offering body, mind, and emotions, your karmic nature, your desires, your fears, your hopes, that all of these are being breathed out and entering into the great light. And with the thought, I am that, in this moment, you just offer yourself to that one who is the source of all. And then breathe that divine light and love into your own body. As we bring tonight's class to a close, I'd like to suggest that you just take a few minutes to really establish this breathing pattern. I am flowing in with the sense of Krishna entering you through the crown, flowing through your body, and then exhaling with the thought, I am that. Allowing the mind and your sense of self to rise, aspire, intend to recognize its oneness with that great light that is all this. And just allow that to be your practice for the evening, even as you eat and hang out and take care of your duties. When Krishna says, give up all dharmas, all practices, meaning all rules and regulations, really, and take refuge in me, what he obviously means is not that you should stop doing the good things you do, that create beauty and goodness in your life. What he means is that you should recognize that the divine Shakti, Krishna, exists in everything. And that there's therefore no need to attach to anything, or to be anxious or worried, because all of it is that divine energy that is manifesting as all this. And that when you breathe with the recognition that the divine is breathing you, exhaling with the recognition that everything you are can be offered back into that which you truly are, then Dharma becomes a natural expression of your being. And your thoughts and actions become beneficial, because what is offered to the divine becomes permeated with the energy of that sacred source. So you'll be getting a homework assignment. This is a practice week, of course. It's our final practice week. Do sign up for the class next week, in which we'll be breaking into groups and discussing various key teachings and verses of the Gita, as well as your own experience. Thank you so much for being here, for practicing, for your seriousness and brilliance and love. Namaste.